This is the Bible Show.
Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me is Will. And today we're continuing our series in Genesis. We're in Genesis 41 today. And today we get to the stage where Joseph's circumstances finally take a turn for the better. Because prior to this, what's Joseph's life look like?
Has been great. Well, it started off really well.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite son status would have been good until he was obviously sold into slavery by his brothers.
That's right. So like every bit about this story, like you can almost trace Joseph's life by remembering kind of the biblical pattern of Jesus, mm-hmm. where it's like, here's the favored son. He's clothed, right? His father gives him the clothed majesty robe, whatever. And then his brothers hate him. They betray him, 12 of the brothers, right? Judas betrays him for silver. He's sold to Ishmaelite, Midianite traders, taken down to Egypt where he goes, and he becomes a slave in the house of Potiphar. What happens?
His wife lies.
But the Lord is with him. He gets to be the chief of the house. Then the wife lies, takes his coat again. So there's a familiar pattern. He's accused of like attempted rape. He's thrown into prison. Then he becomes, God is with him in all these circumstances. He elevates to the chief of the prison, essentially. And then who comes into the prison?
Cupbearer.
The baker and the cupbearer. The cup, he interprets, hey, you're going to be restored in 3 days. Pharaoh's going to restore you. But he says, hey, remember me. When you get back to your kingdom, when you get back to your role, tell Pharaoh about me because I shouldn't be here. And then the last chapter ends with the words, cupbearer did not remember Joseph. And so this chapter, chapter 41, you got to imagine this. So he's done an 11 years of slavery and prison combined. We don't know what the mix is. But now verse 1 starts after 2 whole years.
Wow.
So like if you said that and you're like, hey, I want you to go and tell somebody like I'm innocent. Tell them what, you know, show them, tell them about how God favors me and how, you know, I'm innocent and I shouldn't be here. And then cupbearer walks out of the prison and Joseph is like, all right, any day now, any day.
Yeah. What day would you be like, he forgot?
Well, I don't know. Like I'm so pessimistic. I would be
day
like,
two, you'd be like, oh, yeah, it's I'm over. Yeah,
right. But like, that's the worst part. Like, you can endure, if you know things are going to be bad, you can kind of steel your mind and brace for bad.
Yeah.
But the moment that you're given some semblance of hope and you allow yourself to hope again and then the bad happens, it's crushing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like, if you're running a marathon and you think you see the end, I've never experienced this, but
this is an illustration.
Totally hypothetical. But you see the finish line, and then you're like, oh, and your body like is like, oh, I can finally start to like relax because there it is. But then it's like a fake, and you've got to go another half a mile or something. That last half a mile is brutal. I mean, it's the same with anything. If you think you're coming to an end with something that requires endurance, and it's a false start, like a false end, it just crushing.
Hard to keep going, yeah.
It's crushing. And so Joseph has 2 years now where this one who should have remembered him totally forgot. And then at the end of this 2 years, really hard time, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing at the Nile. So he would get another dream. Like this, so you'll hear Joseph referred to as the king of dreams, the dreamer. Like all over his story, you find these dreams. And now the dreams, God has brought dreams to Pharaoh. God brought dreams to Joseph to say, you're going to be elevated. God brought dreams to the baker and the cupbearer that Joseph interpreted. Now dreams are coming to Pharaoh. And who is Pharaoh in Egypt?
Top dog.
He's top dog. So here you've got this dream of Pharaoh standing by the Nile, and it's just compounding symbolism. Like if you're an Egyptian and you're putting this together, there's so much symbolism. Because Pharaoh is not just top dog in Egypt and king, but they see him as a
god.
God. And he's standing next to the Nile, which in Egypt is like the most sacred thing that you have in all of Egypt, because it is the source of all life in Egypt, right? All of your crops. Like I read a stat, I wrote it down here, that in that day, more than 90% of Egypt's population live within a mile of the Nile River. Today, 95% of Egyptians live within 3 kilometers of the Nile.
Wow. Yeah, if you see a photo of the Nile and everything around it, you're like,
yeah. You're not going too far from that. It's like strip of green and everything else is just sand and dirt. Like you can't live out there. And so the Egyptians' place, and this is just, it's important to understand this when you get into the dream of how everybody else would have seen this. But in those days, the Nile was life. And so they had a god Hapi that was like the god of the Nile. And you made offerings like, because if the Nile, it had to flood exactly between 18 to 23 feet, right?
Okay.
So if it flooded less than that, you couldn't irrigate out to reach the crops, which meant what? What's coming?
Everyone's dead.
Everyone's dead. You're going to have a famine, like, because the water doesn't reach far enough for all the farmlands to get their water. If it's over 23 feet, what's happening? You get like flash flood and it's going to wreck everything and it's going to destroy everything and it's going to leave all your crops and farmlands in devastation. And even though the water's there, you can't do anything with it because it's wrecked it. So in either case, if it's less than 18 feet or over 23 feet, you have devastation and a massive famine coming. And so everybody in those days, it was like, what's going to happen with the Nile? What's going to happen with the Nile? What's going to happen with the Nile? And here's an kind of an interesting thing, just historically. We know that Joseph, dating in the Bible, he would be in the 12th dynasty of Egypt.
Okay.
Just prior to that, you have something called, I mean, you Google this, but you have something called the Great Drought of Egypt, which is in the dynasties before Joseph. You had a drought that plagued Egypt, series of droughts that plagued Egypt. Tons of people died. It wrecked Egypt massively prior to this. And so now when you get into the 12th dynasty, everybody's on edge.
Yeah, that's a real fear.
Everybody's on edge because you remember like last century, we had mass starvation repeatedly. It wrecked Egypt. It nearly ended us. Like, and now all the pharaohs are writing about water levels. Like you see the pharaoh of Joseph's lifetime, we believe is Amenemhat the third, constantly writing about water levels of the Nile. And so when Pharaoh is standing next to the Nile, it's not like, oh, this is a pretty nice little creek that I'm
not a beachside condo.
Yeah, he's not on vacation. That's not what it's saying. Like this is the source of life with the one who's represented as God to supply life over all of Egypt. And this is a big deal. In verse 2, it says, and behold, next to the god, who's next to the Nile, which is the personification of Hapi, the Nile god, out of that came up from the Nile seven cows, attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. So what's interesting about this, like, if you don't know, which I didn't until 2 days ago.
So none of us know.
Right. So like, but in this, seven cows come up and you're like, okay, well, seven's the number of perfection in the Bible. Yeah. You see a lot of sevens in the Bible, but seven's really significant in Egypt. This would have been something that Pharaoh, when he sees this vision in his dream, immediately he would have associated this with something called the seven cows of Hathor. So Google that. Hathor is the Egypt. Sorry, am I like?
No, keep going. No,
we got some more of this. So Hathor is going to be the god of fertility. She's an Egyptian goddess. She is the one who brings life. She takes the form of a cow, right? Hathor is one of the most famous gods, the one with the sun disk and the horns that come up. You see in Egyptian hieroglyphs if you ever look into Egypt stuff. And so from Hathor kind of manifests herself in seven different cows that are known from ancient Egyptian literature. And what these cows do, Hathor's also the goddess of music. And you think, oh, she's a party god, like party goddess. But the reason why she's the goddess of music is she's the god of the celestial timetable, right? And so you know how rhythm, like da-da-dun, dun-dun, you know where that goes? Like it's rhythm, it's rhythmic, it's predictable, you know what's coming. And so Hathor is the goddess of the celestial realm because they saw all the stars worked like clockwork. They worked on a rhythm, right?
Yeah.
And so she, Hathor, and the seven goddesses, the seven cows of Hathor, were fortune tellers because you could predict rhythmically what's coming in the celestial realm with the sky. Huh, right? You following? You tracking? Sense. This?
Well, they're putting a lot into one basket.
Right.
It does make sense if you think about it.
So it's like a music, and God's doing a musical and how the stars come up. It's like with a rhythm, you can figure it out. You can anticipate what's coming every night. Where's this, you know, constellation that should be coming up right now? There it is, right on rhythm. Mm. And so Hathor's the goddess of music, and the seven cows, the Egyptian mythology is
that when a baby's born, the seven cows look over every baby and they say, this is your future. This is your blessing. This is your curse. They determine the date of your death. Like, these seven cows are the ones that determine everything about you from the moment of your birth. Okay?
That's wild.
So now I want you to imagine Pharaoh has a dream where he's next to the Nile. What's the Nile?
Life source.
It's the source of all life. And out of the Nile comes cows, which are, they would remind you of what goddess?
Hathor.
Hathor, who is the goddess of fertility.
A lot of stuff.
Actually, really a lot of stuff. But fertility, and also is associated with the seven cows that are like the fortune-telling kind of creatures.
That's your life plan.
That's right. So everything's determined. And so now when Pharaoh sees seven cows...
Oh, he's stressed.
They're coming up, and it's like, wait a minute. They determine life and death. They appoint all things. They're the fortune tellers. What's going on? Oh, but cool. They're really fat. Like, this is great. Okay, they're attractive and plump. This is good news for me. They're feeding in reed grass. Everything is healthy and good in the world because, wow, everything is working according to plan. If the seven cows are happy and Hathor's looking good, good things must be coming, right? But this is where he gets troubled. And behold, verse 3, seven other cows. Uh-oh, wait a minute. Another seven cows. Like, okay, so this is like divine realm. We're talking about celestial. It's the seven cows. So it's prophetic. It's fortune-telling according to the Egyptian way of seeing things, except they're ugly. And the root word behind that Hebrew ugly, it's evil. Like, they come up evil, ugly. Like, they're maleficent, whatever the word is. Like, they're not looking to do good. They're like, you imagine them, like in my mind, I imagine like snarling ugly. Mm. They traumatize Pharaoh. Like, he's like, they freak him out. Thin cows. And that word thin literally means like disintegrating. It's like powder.
See their ribs. Okay.
It's like powder that you've ground something down and it's just becoming smaller and smaller. That's the word thin. Thin cows ate up the seven attractive plump cows. What's weird about that?
That just wouldn't work like that.
Yeah.
Thin cows don't eat plump cows.
Cows don't eat meat. Like, they don't eat other creatures, period, right?
I guess that's true, too. I would never thought of that one.
So the first ones come up, and they're, like, in the reed grass, which is weird because cows, you know, reed grass isn't the best for cows, but they can eat them, whatever. But then the next ones come up, and we got carnivorous cows. And by the way, it's kind of weird that cows are coming up out of the Nile to begin with. Like, cows did bathe in the Nile, but, like, emerging, like, I didn't see them before. Like, they're scuba diving or something. Like, they're just coming up out of the Nile. So everything about this is supernatural, but if you see seven cows and think seven cows of Hathor coming up and they're ugly and malicious and they're associated with fortune telling and determining death and everything else, and now they come and eat what your happy vision was, that, oh, Hathor's doing well. She's fat and plump and like things are good. This looks good for us. But they get devoured.
It's not good.
Now all of a sudden, Pharaoh's going, what does this mean? Yeah. Like, I don't like this. And our fortune-telling seven cows, like, if that's what this is about, this is not something that I'm thrilled with. And Pharaoh awoke. And so one of the things you're going to see in this chapter, and these are kind of my theories. Like, I take the Bible as the chief authority. But I think this colors, because one of the things that God does all the time is he'll tell a story in a way that when we read this, we're like, that's just weird.
Yeah.
But then when you understand what the ancients believed about it, God is providing a context that Pharaoh would have been like, okay, I understand this from my culture, but God is using what we believe about our culture to blow up my categories, to show me that my gods are no good, yeah, to show me that my gods are powerless. You saw him do this with Abraham and his gods of fertility, right? And the plagues of Moses, you'll see every one of the plagues tears down the gods of Egypt. And you're seeing this here. You got Hathor. This is supposed to be the one who provides abundance. He should care for you, Pharaoh. And the seven cows, like, are they on your team or not? Because it looks like this is not great for Egypt. Are they turning on you? And by the way, if they're the fortune-telling God, why is it that all of your priests, as we're going to see in a minute, none of them can interpret it? And Joseph comes along and is like, yep, only God can do that. Only my God can do that. And so all of this is setting up a battle between the mythology, the religion of Egypt, and the one true God of Joseph. That's where we're going.
Yeah, that's helpful because, like, from our day and age, we read this story and we're like, if I had a dream about cows, I wouldn't be too troubled about it. Like, if I came in here this morning and be like, seven cows came out of the river, you'd be like, cool. Mm-hmm.
But for Pharaoh, this is real. Like, he's saying, okay, something is being acknowledged here that I need to seek out answers to.
That's right. And remember, at this particular time in Egypt is when you get all the dream manuals going. Like, they put a lot of weight in dreams. And it's like, you wonder, like, did God ordain all that so that he could have this moment where Pharaoh's like, my dreams matter because I have crazy dreams. If I tried to interpret every dream that I had, I'd be a crazy person. But Pharaoh here's like, this means something.
Yeah.
And now I've got all this, the seven cows. What are the chances of that? And me standing next to the Nile, like, what are the chances of that? And so he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. So he's had this disturbing dream, didn't love that one. But now it's like, whew, that was bad. Okay, now I'm going to go back to sleep.
Poor guy.
You can relate, can't you?
Maybe it's narcolepsy.
That's it. Probably has narcolepsy. So he fell asleep and dreamed a second time, and behold, seven ears of grain. Oh, here we go. Life again. This is good. Fertility. All right. Whew. I was worried about those seven ugly cows. You know, I imagine when he talks about the ugly cows, like, that they're like demonic, or like, I bet they scarred him. Like he says later on, like, I've never seen anything like it. Like, he's like, they were freaky. So now 7 years of grain, plump and good, we're growing on a stalk. And you're like, oh, thank you. Like, fertility, finally. Like, our crops are going to be good. I don't have to worry about that. And then verse 6, and behold, after them sprouted 7 years, thin and blighted by the east wind. So what that means, the east wind came out of the Sahara moving eastward. But this really dry, anyway, coming out of the Sahara, this dry, hot wind just crushed the
destroys
crops.
Things.
And so you had these, oh, they're wonderful, grain, plump and good, growing on a stalk, and after them sprouts 7 years, thin, just wasting away and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the seven plump full ears, and Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. So that's not good again.
No.
So what's going on here is you have an Egyptian god Napur, and if you do a Google image search or something on the god Napur, he's a god of grain. But what you notice is in all the image that you'll see, you know, stalks of grain, or I'm sorry, the ears of grain coming out while the god is holding a single stalk, and that doesn't happen, right? One stalk, one ear. Like, it comes out and it grows, and it doesn't do multiple. Like, it's possible, but that's like pretty supernatural, and it's very, very unusual. It's a sign of like mega abundance. And so in this dream, when he sees, you know, one stalk and then all of a sudden it's growing all the ears on top of like the grain, the kernels and everything, he's like, whoa, this is miraculous. This is great news for me. And then these blighted, yucky, weed looking grains come up and swallow it all. It's like, again, abundance of fertility and things, all of this is pointing you to Egyptian mythology and gods, and then it just gets swallowed. And so he's again left going, I don't like that. Now he's really troubled. And a little note that's interesting is when it says that they were plump and good, or for the cows, it refers to them as attractive. It's beautiful of sight. What does that make you think? Beautiful to the eyes.
Oh, back to the garden.
Back to the garden. And now it's just another thing where it's like when something else sees that something is beautiful and consumes it, what's always to follow? Death. I don't know if that's intentional, but it's the same language here. And so it's like the seven skinny cows eat the seven fat, beautiful of sight cows, and then death follows. That's the interpretation. It's following the pattern.
Weird calling cows beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
As well said, it's just lump.
I don't like that word. It's too close to home. Anyway, that's just a wrong word. Doesn't that sound gross?
It plump. It does feel weird reading. I don't know if I've ever seen the word plump written.
Plump. It just sounds right. Plump.
Well, it sounds like what it means.
Yeah.
It's one of those words plump. Where you're like, that is what it is.
It's kind of a gross word. All right, verse 8. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled. This has been a terrible night of sleep. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Like, okay, you're the ones who call on, you know,
the dream team.
Nice.
Look at that.
Trademark. That's a good one. So he calls on I'm going to call it that, the dream team. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Like, this isn't in our manuals.
That would be such a stressful job. That sure. You have the guy who controls everything telling you his wild, crazy dreams. And he's like, what does that mean? And you're like,
Because if you get it wrong.
Yeah, you're dead.
You're done. You're done. So they're like, this isn't in our manuals. We haven't seen anything like this. Like, I don't want to risk an interpretation. I don't feel confident of anything. So good for them for not lying. And Pharaoh's just left troubled, which, by the way, that word, it's kind of interesting. The behind the Hebrew, it's like literally somebody who's just banging an anvil or a bell.
Huh.
Like, that's the idea. There's a repeated, like, I can't get it out of my head. It just sits there and like trouble, like an alarm bell in his head. So nobody can interpret it, which means all of the magician, the religion of Egypt is failing him, right? Like, they're calling on these gods. None of them are showing up. None of them are giving an interpretation. Hathor's not helping. Nepher's not helping. Pharaoh himself, a god, can't figure this out. So verse 9, then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today. Now, what is that? That just gave you a clue of something.
He did something.
He
wrong.
Did something, right? Because Remember, like, we were like, oh, you know, did they really betray him? Who's guilty? Now he's like, I remember my sins today, which means he did something and Pharaoh had to forgive him and restore him. I don't know if he was plotting against his life, but he did something to make Pharaoh mad.
Or
he's admitting it.
Or is that him admitting that he forgot Joseph?
Because the next line is when Pharaoh was angry with his servants. So it's what he did to Pharaoh.
To anger Pharaoh.
Or maybe, I've never thought about it from Joseph. I think it's he offended Pharaoh. But I guess it could technically work both ways. But verse 10, it says, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief cup baker, good grief, I'm inventing things, chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. And a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. And when we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office and the baker was hanged. This guy, like, we were both troubled by our dreams and he knew it. And he was spot on, like, down to the day. This guy knows what he's doing. Like, maybe you should ask him.
What a wild thing to forget if you're this guy. You're like, you had this almost supernatural interpretation that everything came out right. Now 2 years later, you're just like, oh yeah, that did happen. The greatest day of my life. Yeah. I'm just remembering it now.
And you think about this, like, if it's almost a good thing that the cupbearer did forget Joseph until this moment. Because what would have happened if he'd have been like, hey, he's innocent, and they let him go 2 years earlier. What would he have done?
Yeah.
He has he's not jumping into Pharaoh's court. Like, where does he go?
Or if the cupbearer came to Pharaoh just out of the blue, is like, I got a guy who interprets dreams. Pharaoh's like, whatever. I haven't had one in a while.
So, I mean, it's like for this moment that he endured those 2 years. It's kind of weird to think about. Like, you personalize that.
Yeah,
where it's like, how much longer is God going to allow me to go through this season? You never know if he's holding you out for 2 years for a moment that you'll be grateful that he did.
Yeah, that's one of the major themes of the Bible that I don't like personally, mm-hmm. is the waiting game and the purposefulness in our waiting. Like, you think of the major characters, Abraham waited, Joseph waited,
Isaac.
Moses takes decades for anything to happen in his life. And you're like, I don't want that to be my story.
Yeah. We don't even think in terms of years. There were decades.
Yeah.
We're like, all right, God, this has been 2 weeks. Like, like, can't handle it.
I prayed this morning, God.
I'm going to put my prayer in the microwave and see if I can hurry this up. Like, we are so, like, on demand that the idea that God works in our story over decades is, like, just can't even think that. But, I mean, you look back at your life. You could probably think of some things where he's been working on you for decades.
Yeah.
I can think of stories of people that have been praying for things for decades that came to pass. But anyway, God plays the long game,
yeah.
And we're good to keep that in mind. So anyway, he identifies Joseph, and so you got to imagine how Pharaoh is hearing this. No one else and his whole team knows what to do.
Yeah.
And a prisoner in the house of the captain of the guard, a foreigner, is like, he can do it. If you're Pharaoh, like, all of a sudden you're like, what's going on with my team? Like, I got the best that money can buy and they all stink. Like, none of the gods are performing. I'm totally in the dark. This thing is pounding. It's drumming in my head like an anvil. I'm so troubled. Nobody can give me any relief. And you're telling me that of all the things that Egypt has to offer with all of its magic and da-da-da-da-da, I got to bring in a foreigner? So already you see, like, in him is going to be questions and doubts and his own stuff.
And that's how troubled he is, because this is kind of humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
You bring everyone that you've resourced and been like, you guys are the ones who solved my problems. They can't. Now you got to go to some, imagine you coming to me and being like, hey, I got an answer to your problem. We got to go to the county jail and get this guy that I met 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You might be like, no.
Who's a radically different religion? Yeah. Who can heal you?
Yeah. I'd be like, I don't think so.
Right? Like, you got to set aside all your loyalties, all your your confidences. Like, think about, it's like Naaman the Syrian coming to get healing from Elijah. Like, it's like he's got to set aside, because his desperation of having leprosy in that story makes him worthy to set aside all of his pride and all of his preconceived ideas and to go to a foreigner enemy who's, you know, he looked down upon. Same thing's going on here, where you have Pharaoh, who is so desperate. Listen to the next verse, verse 14. Pharaoh sent and called Joseph. Not like, do I want a foreigner? Do I want a, you know, somebody who doesn't believe the same as we do? No, he sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. In other words, Pharaoh needs an answer now. This is driving the man crazy. He needs to stop the troubling drumbeat going on in his head. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, this is talking about Joseph, he came in before Pharaoh. And so, like, think it boggles my mind. So it's 13 years of slavery, imprisonment, prayers, wondering how long, the cupbearer betrays him, and all it takes is Pharaoh to go, I need him now.
Yeah.
And that changes your fate. Pharaoh desires something for 1 second. You've desired something for 13 years, and all it took was for him to say the word.
Sure.
That's just crazy. Like, that's a kind of a mind-boggling thing. So anyway, and what do you notice? Joseph is changing his clothes. What does that mean?
Ooh, something's happening. I don't know what, but
the circumstances are about to change. Every time he gets betrayed, he loses his clothes. He gets, you know, falsely accused, he loses his robe. Every time he loses his robes or gains a robe, his circle, he gets the favored coat of his father. Like, his circumstances are changing.
You'd think he'd hold on to those a little better.
Right?
If you're him, you'd be like,
that's right.
Every time I lose this, bungee cords, terrible happens. Buy a belt.
So, and by the way, Joseph isn't shaving like we would think, like, oh, it's a job interview. I want to look nice. I'm going to get rid of the beard, which in Hebrew culture, beards were the norm. They were seen as masculine. You wanted to have those. In Egyptian culture, when you got to nobility or royalty, do you see, like, go look at hieroglyphs or wall paintings or stuff like, do you ever see Egyptians with beards?
No.
You don't. And by the way, if you're a priest, they're always bald headed. They always have their eyebrows shaved off. They're hairless. Why?
I have no idea.
Because of cleanliness. Like, your hair draws oils and dirt and
that makes
bugs
sense.
In the ancient world, lice were much,
like, if you're not showering problem. All that often, your hair would get
that's right.
Most fast.
And so he's not shaving for a job interview. He's shaving because he's going into the presence of Pharaoh, and he has to be utterly clean.
Oh, because Pharaoh's a god. Yeah.
That's correct. That is correct. And so Herodotus writes this. He's a Greek historian, comes much later than Joseph, but these customs are still happening. And Herodotus writes this. He says, the priests shaved themselves all over their body every other day so that no lice or any other foul thing may come to be upon them when they minister to the gods. They washed themselves in cold water twice in the day and twice again in the night. So cleanliness in Egypt, especially when you're going before holy things, sacred things, the Pharaoh, like, was essential. And so now it's telling you Joseph is playing the role of a holy man in the court of Pharaoh. He's becoming ritually cleansed in the sight of Pharaoh,
which is interesting.
Again, change of circumstance. You go from being the lowest in the pit to now shaved, ritually cleaned, purified in the sight of Pharaoh. Verse 15, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it.
He's like, finally, I wanted you to hear that 2 years ago.
Yeah. Right. But notice think about this. You're Joseph, and Pharaoh's coming to you being like, you will.
Yeah.
I've heard it said of you.
It's a stressful.
That you are amazing. You are so amazing. I'm so glad that you are in my presence because you can interpret the dreams. And if you're Joseph, what would be, it would be so tempting to be like, yeah, you're right. You really need me, right? And what does Joseph do?
Yeah, well, not just the ego, but also like, I'm in front of Pharaoh and I don't want to get this wrong.
Yeah. Yeah,
like,
true.
You control a lot. So like, I'm trying to use less words than more words.
True. Yeah. I don't want to correct you because,
but again,
I want to live.
Joseph's even from the pit. He's genuine.
But here's Pharaoh heaping praise, you know, which is like to get this from Pharaoh would have been amazing. You, I mean, the pressure's high. Like, you better perform.
Shoot. Anyone gives me a compliment, not even Pharaoh status. Yeah. I'm doing great.
Yeah. Yeah, you're head.
Yeah, so imagine Pharaoh.
But here, receiving all that, Joseph answered Pharaoh and says, it's not me. It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Wow. Like, that is such a bold thing. Here you're standing in front of a God who's had all these dreams about symbols of their gods, and all of your priests and your religious figures are all, you know. And then it's like, okay, well, maybe we'll try this Hebrew. And the Hebrew's like, it's not me. It's my God. Yeah, all your gods are garbage. My God will give you an answer.
Your first impression.
It's evangelistic, man. He is laying it down. And it's, I bring nothing to the table. God alone can help you. And I think that is such a beautiful picture of the way we're supposed to be, you know, where it's like, wow, you know, Will, you're amazing at student ministry. Look at the fruit that you've got. Oh, you've done this and you've done this and you've done this and you've done this, and only you could do it. Like, if you allow that to come into you, one, it builds your identity to where you're on the performance rat race to keep that identity alive.
Better not mess it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you build it, you mess it up. But if you say, like, if you have the wisdom to say, all this is because of God's faithfulness. Mm-hmm. Like, I bring nothing to the table. He works through me. Like, he gets the credit. He gets the glory. That does two things. One, it honors him. But then two, it takes you off the pressure because I'm not the one who built this.
Yes.
Right? It's not mine to sustain. Yeah, like, free. I'm not in charge of the results. I'm in charge of faithfully doing what God's called me to do. I am not in charge of the results. God built this. God could tear it down. Like, I am not on the hook for this. My identity isn't based on whether or not I successfully interpret your dream. If God wants to do that, that's his prerogative. This isn't me.
And I think it's an interesting nod towards common grace even. Because Joseph's saying, God is going to give you, Pharaoh, who doesn't believe in God, who thinks you're a God himself, he's going to give you a favorable answer, and I believe that. Which I think is fascinating to have that kind of confidence and faithfulness in God to a watching world that is wondering who this God is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, that God is good in a way that says, like, hey, you don't believe God, you're not even on his team, but he's going to show you grace and mercy, and he's going to allow me to interpret the dream.
It's cool. And then behind that, think about, he's not just going to give relief to Pharaoh for the dreams, but what he's ultimately staging behind all this is he's going to save all these Egyptians. He's going to save people from the whole region of the world, like, that don't believe in him, who don't love him. His own people don't love him very well. Like, and yet God's grace is upon all of them. And so Pharaoh now gets in, and there's going to be a lot of repetition of the details of this dream. We'll get it three times. It's a longer chapter, but bear with us. So Pharaoh says to Joseph, behold, in my dream, I was standing on the banks of the Nile. Seven cows, plump and attractive, came up out of the Nile and fed in the reed grass, and then seven other cows came up after them. Poor. Oh, and very ugly. Thin, such as I had never seen in all of Egypt. Like, I've never seen anything like these. They were so awful. And the thin, ugly cows ate up the first seven plump cows. Like, literally imagine this. Like, angry, ugly, nasty cows come about, and they're, like, devouring cows like crocodiles. What does that look like? Like, this would have been traumatizing. But when they had eaten them, no one would have known that they'd eaten them, for they were still as ugly as at the beginning. So in other words, these demonic, gross, evil-looking cows come up. They're skinny as can be. They eat these massively fat cows, and it's like, where did it go? Like, you didn't gain any weight. You didn't get bigger. It's like, it's just this. And what is that communicating? That this evil is a, you can't fill it. It can't be satisfied. It will never grow it. It's this, this black hole that just consumes everything and would never end. It would never be satiated. It will just devour everything in its path. And that's a pretty good picture of evil, isn't it? Like, evil never is satiated where it's like, all right, I'm going to take a break, do some good for a while. Like, it'll take everything you offer it. It'll just devour and devour and devour and devour and nothing, like, it never gets full. And so that's part of the reason why this is so disturbing, is it's not like Pharaoh's like, okay, he's full now, he's going to stop.
It's over, yeah.
It just devours everything. And then when the seven cows are done, it's like, what are they going to go after next? Because I woke up. Like, this is a terrifying, terrifying dream. And so it says, Pharaoh goes on, he says, then I awoke. And I also saw in my dream, seven ears growing on one stalk, full and good. That's amazing. 7 ears, withered thin and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the seven good ears. I told it to my magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me.
Have you ever seen yourself in a dream? Have you ever dreamed not in your perspective? Like, you're an omniscient drone in the sky?
No, never that. Okay. It was a mirror.
Okay. That just seems like Pharaoh's like watching himself, it seems. Yeah. I think that was just an interesting. I was just thinking, me personally, I've never done that. So
yeah, I've never been outside myself watching myself in a dream.
Okay. Just wondering.
Which, by the way, in the manual, remember what it said about that? That if you see yourself in your dream.
Ooh, not good.
Not good. Not good. So then Joseph said to Pharaoh, again, the boldness here, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. Even though you have two dreams, it's the same dream.
He needed the message twice.
Now listen to what he says. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do.
Heck yeah.
Like, he's laying it down. And by the way, notice that. It's not just God who's interpreting the dream. What does Joseph say? Because that's what Pharaoh's looking for. Like, he's trusting all of the gods of Egypt are carrying out their normal functions, right? I just need an interpretation of what they mean here. Like, what did this dream mean? And Joseph is like, one, God's going to reveal it to you. Hmm. So he's interpreting, but what's the next part? Because it's even more bold. What he is about to do. It's not your stupid gods.
Yeah, like, you can't stop this either.
Yeah, Nepr, nope, not going to help you. Horus, Ra, like, none of the gods are involved in this. My God is the one who controls Egypt, its farmlands, its flooding, its famines, its abundance. My God is the one who's going to do this. And it's like, Joseph, you know, like, he's laying it down. And by the way, in the Hebrew, it says, the translation is what he's about to do, but... And the language there, the tense of the verb is, it's already underway. Okay, he's already doing this. It's coming. It has already started, and it's going to carry out is the idea. So it's like when Joseph is saying this, he's like, he's already started this. He's going to do it. He's already started. So if you're Pharaoh, you're like, okay.
And Pharaoh's not the guy who you come to and say, like, this is happening. Usually you're asking his opinion.
Right.
Like, truth. It's been a while since Pharaoh's been like, oh, this is just, I don't have a decision in this?
Yeah. Which makes you wonder, like, if you're Pharaoh, you get all the yes men around you who are telling you, you know, like, oh, you know, this, it's, you know, the dream means that you're amazing, you know. Here, Joseph is going to tell him something that's really not pleasant, you know, and this, your gods are nothing, my God is the one doing this. Also something Pharaoh probably wouldn't have loved to hear. Verse 26, it says, the seven good cows are 7 years. I have no idea. That comes straight from God. Like, I have no idea why seven cows would mean 7 years. It's just straight. It's revelation from God, which shows that this man is a prophet.
Yeah.
And seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. And the seven empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. And now everything in Pharaoh's got to be like, oh, no. Like, we live and die by famine.
Yeah.
Pharaoh reigns. Like, our reputations, our legacies are determined overwhelmingly by famine. You go read the ancient tomb inscriptions, and you'll find, I delivered my people from the famines. It's all the pharaohs bragging about how they never faced famines. The ones that did get hit by famines are, like, remembered with shame. And now you've told Pharaoh famine's coming, which means it's not just your people are going to die. and they're going to be more revolutionary because there's poverty and desperation, and they're going to start robbing from each other. And by the way, if your people aren't eating, guess what else isn't eating? You're going to start losing your cattle and all of your herds because you can't feed them and there's nothing for them to eat. And you can't mobilize an army because you can't feed the army to go anywhere. And you've got all of this. Your kingdom is about to crumble underneath you. So 60 years before Joseph, there's a vizier, meaning another number two guy. His name's Amenhi. This was on the wall of his tomb, just to give you an example. No one was unhappy in my days, not even in the years of famine, for I had tilled all the fields of Noam of Ma up to its southern and northern frontiers. Thus, I prolonged the life of its inhabitants and preserved the food which it produced. Like, you see those kinds of inscriptions. I saved my people from famine, or there was no famine in my days. This is a big deal. So when Joseph lays down, famine is coming, and it's going to be rough.
Yeah, and this guy's thinking about his, what are they going to write about me?
Yeah.
What's going to survive generations about what I did or didn't do in order?
Yeah, your whole identity just blew up in your face.
That's stressful.
And so he says, it is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do, what he is already doing. This is a, he's not holding back, man. So verse 29, there will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. Nobody's going to care all the good that you did. Nobody's going to care that, you know, it was amazing. Oh my goodness, this Pharaoh is so amazing. We've had such abundance. It's a wonder. All forgotten. There, it's going to be miserable. Nobody's going to give you any props for what you've done. Everybody's going to be struggling. The world is going to fall into like this dark period. He goes on, the famine will consume the land and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow. It just for it will be very severe. The word there for severe is kaved. Do you remember what that means?
It's a, that's not weight.
Yeah, very good. So it's greater glory. In other words, he's saying that word severe, it's going to crush everything. Like everything you've built up, it's just, it's too heavy. It's going to crush everything underneath it. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is absolutely fixed by God. God will shortly bring it about. You don't have time. Like this is underway already. You don't have time to sit around and negotiate as to whether or not you can trust me. You don't have time. Like, you've got to move now or you're done, right? Intense. So pause for a moment. Put on your nerdy hat because I've got another theory.
Okay.
You ready for this theory?
I am.
This goes back into Egyptian history, but I'm gaining more and more convinced of this. So if you went back, the oldest pyramid, were you there?
I didn't.
Your wife was there. So the oldest pyramid that is in Egypt is the pyramid of a pharaoh named Djoser. And the oldest pyramid, it's at Saqqara. You can go there. You can look at it. It's a stepped pyramid. But this particular pharaoh, he lived in 2700 BC, so a good bit before Joseph, like 800 or 900 years before Joseph. But he becomes extremely famous for this pyramid. And he had a number two guy of a high priest whose name was Amenhotep. Have you ever heard, or Imhotep, sorry. Have you ever heard that name, Imhotep?
Is that the guy from The Mummy?
The Mummy, yeah. So like the bald-headed guy. What's the name of that actor? I can't remember.
I don't know.
He always plays kind of creepy figures.
Yeah.
But anyway, like the people come up from the dead and they're like, Imhotep, yeah. Imhotep. And they're walking like mummies. This is
okay. That's our
Djoser's number two guy, okay? So during his reign, he gets hit with a seven-year famine. Oof. Sound familiar?
Oof.
Very famous because he's one of the foundational pharaohs in all of Egyptian history. Okay. And he writes, and we have something called the famine stela, which is his record of this famine. Listen to what he writes. He says, I was in mourning on my throne. Those of the palace were in grief. My heart was in great affliction because Hapi, who's the Nile god, had failed to come in a period of 7 years. Grain was scant, kernels were dried up, scarce was every kind of food. Every man robbed his twin, and those who entered did not go. Children cried, youngsters fell, the hearts of the old were grieving. Legs drawn up, they hugged the ground, their arms collapsed about them. Courtiers were needy, temples were shut, shrines covered with dust. Everyone was in distress.
It's a downer.
7-year famine wrecked, right? But now follow the story, because Djoser has a number two guy. And you know what he says to the number two guy, Imhotep? He's like, you're really good at building pyramids, and you're great, and you're the high priest. By the way, the world's first documented physician. So, like, he talks about circulation and the blood pumping and all that stuff. He's so famous in Egypt, this guy Imhotep, that he later is exalted to become the god of medicine and healing and wisdom in Egypt. So he becomes a god after he dies. So the Pharaoh comes to him. Djoser comes to him, and it's like, we got to figure this out. Like, the Nile is failing, so we've got to figure out why the Nile's failing. So you know what he says? He says, Imhotep, I want you to go on an expedition. I want you to find the source of the Nile. Figure out why we're falling into famine, because the Nile is failing. So Imhotep takes a journey. He goes up, and he finds we've discovered a new god. It's the god Khnum. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but K-H-N-U-M, Khnum. And he's the creator god. He's the one who sources the Nile. And he's really upset that we haven't been worshiping him. We haven't been giving him his due for the source of all life. And so what happens goes on in the famine stela that he writes. He says, when I was asleep, my heart was in life and happiness. So he's having a dream. And I found a god standing. And I caused him pleasure by worshiping and adoring him. And he made himself known to me. He said, I'm Khnum, your creator. I know the Nile. And I urge him to the field. I urge him. Life appears in every nose. As one urges the field, I will make the Nile swell for you without there being a year of lack or exhaustion in the whole land. So the plants will flourish, bending under their fruit. So now pause for a moment. You're Pharaoh. 7-year famine's coming. What jumps into your mind? Yeah, I know the records here.
Yeah, the old 7-year famine.
The old 7-year famine. And what happened? There was an unknown god who had failed to be worshipped. That's why everything was failing. And so you put this together, and Joseph starts seeming like he's the new Imhotep. So you got the 7-year famine. You got both of them who become the number two authority in Egypt. Both are going to introduce Pharaoh to a new god. Both are sent by Pharaoh to survey the land and the waters of Egypt. Both are going to end up bringing extreme prosperity to a regime that it would have otherwise been disastrous. And then you get Imhotep, that everybody's like, this guy's clearly from the gods, and they ultimately make him a god.
Hmm.
And so now you get the same story, that God is prepping all of Egyptian history for this Pharaoh to be like, wait a minute.
Yeah, this isn't crazy.
This has happened before. There's an unknown god who's not being worshipped, and he's the one who brings deliverance. Like, it's just the echoes are there. Anyway, personal theory, but I think that's going on. And here you have God being like, it's not Khnum, and it's not Nepr, and it's not, you know, Horus, it's not Hathor, it's not Ra. Like, you're looking to all these things. They're all failing you. Joseph is coming like at the tomb of the unknown God that you see in the New Testament. There's a new God you don't know about.
Yeah.
And it's him who brings you life. And Joseph is the messenger that's like jumping up and down. It is God. It is God. He is the one who brings you life. He's about to do big things. He controls all the details of your kingdom. So just the overlay here, I'm wondering if Pharaoh would have heard all this, looked at the details, and been like, all right, this is very similar.
Well, that's helpful, because again, just like a lot of stories in the Bible, when you read it the first time, you're like, this all just seems wild. Like, none of this makes sense. Why would Pharaoh call this guy to interpret dreams? Why would, when he says what's going on, would that guy be like, oh, that's possible? Like,
man,
famines are just going to pop out of nowhere. We'd have more questions, but like you said, like, God's laid the groundwork for Pharaoh to be like, okay, this is something that we need to deal with.
And God does this so many times. It's like these little details that we look at, you know, and we're like, oh, whatever, okay, this random detail seems kind of weird. Like, God's preaching a message to this Pharaoh, I think. You know, that's my opinion. The scripture doesn't come out and say that, but that's my opinion. Like, you read Egypt, and it's like, there's too much. Like, 7 cows. Like, why? I mean, that's sacred to Egypt. And all these, you know, similar 7 years. And, like, everything is pointing to stuff that they already believed in their folklore that was sacred to them. And God's going, nope, not that. You believe wrongly. Let me show you the real God.
Yeah, it's either wild coincidences or something important.
Agree. That's it. That's it. And I think it's something important. So verse 37, this, did I finish? I didn't finish the first part, did I?
No, verse 34.
Verse 34. Okay. So
let, 33.
Oh, you're right.
We haven't gotten to when he's like, this is my plan.
Okay. All right, so verse 33, now therefore, and then Joseph is like, here's an idea. Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man. Have you met any of those lately? And set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land to take one-fifth of the produce of the land. So this is a heavy taxation, 20% of the fruit of the land of Egypt during the seven plentiful years. And you got to know, you wonder how the Egyptians heard this. Some Hebrew guy showed up and he's like, yeah, famine's coming in 7 years. And all of a sudden your taxes go up to 20%. You're like,
you'd be wildly angry.
You mean? Yeah. Yeah. A libertarian. I'd be like on the anti-Joseph ticket.
Burning down fields.
Anyway, so 20%, right, of the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store it up under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. So 7 years, you're going to have so much, just build these granaries, store it up. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. And remember, Joseph is saying, like, you're not going to remember the great times. So I don't imagine that it's so much that they're just having parties. Like, you're on rations during the years of famine, but you're alive, right? And things are not like, hooray, we're having a party every night and a feast because of the 7 years of abundance, but you're going to survive. Yeah, we're going to get through this.
And that's a dramatic difference between the first seven and the second seven.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like the first seven was one of abundance where you might not be mad about 20% going missing.
That's true. That's a good point.
Like, you might just be like, oh, whoa, we're good. Let's, yeah, this is fine.
And so if Joseph is like, hey, we're going to have 7 years of abundance, and all of a sudden it's abundance, maybe you give him some credibility. Maybe I wouldn't have burned his field down.
Yeah. You're probably like, let's keep this guy around until it goes bad.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting, because they would have made more than 20% of the tax. They were probably still netting some good stuff. Anyway. Interesting. It's kind of fun to just jump into their shoes and imagine like what they're dealing with.
Our crop theories.
And by the way, in the famine of Djoser that we just talked about from Imhotep days, they instituted a 10% tax on production. So there was a pattern there too. Joseph is doubling it. Verse 37, this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all of his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the spirit of God? That's,
which is wild. Is he talking about like the real spirit of God?
That's correct.
Huh.
Yeah. So he's saying nobody's brought me wisdom. Like, his God seems to be working through him. Like, well, we don't have anything to replicate that. So this is a nod that Pharaoh is going, yes, your God. Sold. I will put all my chips on your God versus our gods.
That's super convicting. About like the boldness of evangelism, and like more people are open to talking about this and coming to faith if only I would talk about it.
Yeah.
Because if Pharaoh of all people, who Pharaoh's the last person that should look around and be like, there's a spirit of God that's not me.
Yeah. But you know what? Like, the people, I mean, you know this because we're down in Fort Lauderdale. There's a lot of wealth and success and power and everything else. And you know this as much as I do. Like, some of the most desperate. And some of the ones that think they have it together, it's like they're unreachable until they collapse. But the ones who have realized that all the stuff doesn't fill their soul, it doesn't complete them or satisfy them, they're some of the most desperate people. And what drives Pharaoh to be open to hear Joseph? It's desperation. Yeah. Like, you know, God has crumbled his ability to do things on his own. He's reached the end of himself, and he's like, magicians, interpreters, anyone? I got to get this out of my head. And Joseph shows up and he's like, fine. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm going to give it a chance. And by the way, he's operating on faith, because it's not like Joseph gave him any token of, and here's proof. You know, I'm going to do this sign for you that shows that I really am a prophet.
Yeah, just words at this point.
Just words. And he takes it by complete faith that this God will follow through on his promise.
Yeah, and a whole country's directives are different.
Yeah, I had a seminary professor ask our class, do you think this guy will be in heaven? And I was like,
Pharaoh?
Yeah.
Because
it's like, you know, I'm pretty sure that this goes on and he still allows all the idolatry and everything else to continue. And there's no record at this point of Egypt turning away from its idolatry. And yet you have a Pharaoh who says, by faith alone, I'm going to put the future of Egypt in the hands of this God's message, which is interesting.
Yeah.
You think, okay, is that, I don't know that that would be enough for salvation. I don't know that he's trusting in the promises, you know, of the Messiah coming. But who knows? You never know what Joseph communicated to him. It's fascinating. He seems to have an awful affinity, like a really good affinity toward Joseph's family. He welcomes him, gives him the best. Like, I don't know.
And if this is the one, you have to imagine Joseph's life is not just like sometimes he talks about God. Like every interaction we've seen from him, it seems to be constant. So the more time Pharaoh or anyone spent with him, they're like, okay, we're hearing more about this God.
I won't be shocked if I get to heaven and I get to have a conversation with this Pharaoh. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
I might get roasted for that, but I'll throw it out there. All right, verse 39, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there's none so discerning and wise as you are. Like, so now Pharaoh is giving God the glory, and he's saying, because you serve that God, I'm going to exalt you, which is the way it should be, right? Mm-hmm. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. And this happens to Joseph again and again. He comes into Potiphar's house, number two.
Yeah, just when like take care slightly
of
under, yeah.
Yeah, take care of it all. Just, you know, don't sleep with my wife and I'll take care of what I eat. Then he goes to the prison, number two. He goes here, raised to the right hand of Pharaoh. And that's him. God just blesses him in everything he does, right? And so Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I've set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him. There we go again. Clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot. And like the Egyptians would have known that. This guy's royalty. And they called out before him, bow the knee. That's big. Why?
He's in charge. I mean, that's saying.
What was his dream?
Oh, yeah.
Now we're starting to see some of that come true. I mean, he's been everybody's doormat forever. Any association with humanity only caused him pain. Now all of a sudden the tables are starting to turn. Pharaoh exalts him to number two. He'd gone from being the favorite of his dad at a nomadic tribe to now the favorite of Pharaoh, the most powerful king on the planet Earth.
And the population of Egypt is bowing down as when you
bow the knee. Bow the knee. And he set him over all the land of Egypt. Radical, radical change here, which is, it's fascinating. So moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I'm Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Like you, I want you to micromanage everything. Like nobody moves without you saying so, which is amazing. Like, and if you think, okay, everywhere you go, like blessing upon, I want you over every, I don't want anything to happen without your say so. I want to be particularly blessed. You're over it all. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah. And now this is interesting. It's the words there literally mean God speaks and he lives. That's what that name means. So when he's talking to Joseph, who's God? Is Joseph exalt, like it's Yahweh.
Yeah.
And when Pharaoh gives him a new name, it's God speaks and he lives. Like if you were to take attributes of our God that are so important, what like his word brings life.
Yes.
Right?
Well, that's creation. I mean, that's where it all started.
Jesus is the word and he's also the resurrection and the life. He speaks and he lives. And Pharaoh looks at Joseph and is like, your God's different. Like our gods are silent. We have temples, statues, whatever. Your God actually moves. He speaks. Like he interacts with you. You get information from him, like directly, and he lives. This is different. And so he deciphers that's who your God is, which is pretty awesome. Again, sign of faith. And he gave him marriage to Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. So here you have some questions. He takes an Egyptian. A lot of people give him some grief for this. He takes an Egyptian name. He takes an Egyptian wife. He's making his home in Egypt. And a lot of people will be like, all right, is he assimilating is this a bad thing? And the reality is there's no law against marrying pagan foreigners. That hasn't come yet. The one law is don't marry a Canaanite. But every patriarch thus far has married a pagan foreigner, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you think about this. It's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They're all pagan foreigners. So he's not doing anything different. He's just not going to the land of Abraham's homeland. He's going to Egypt instead. And he marries into this land. And he marries the daughter of a priest, a pagan priest. And yet, you'll see when he has kids, he'll name his kids with Hebrew names. He continues to honor God. So his heart isn't deadening. So anybody who says that he's assimilating and drifting here, I think that's wrong. So verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old. That's a big deal.
It's a lot of time, yeah.
30 years old. So 17, he's betrayed. 30 years old, he's exalted. When he entered the service of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and that's going to become a big thing, because who else is 30 years old when they begin to be exalted? Throughout Jesus, maybe? Like, when he's baptized, we're told he's 30. So he begins his public ministry at the age of 30. King David, guess what age? He becomes king. 30, right? So, like, you have this pattern going on where it's like this age of maturity and strength. He's 30 years old, and Joseph will be the first one. And the priest, by the way, and Numbers, I think it is, Numbers 4, talks about the priest. They become priests at the age of
30.
So there's something about that age that the Bible's like, this is when you get exalted. Huh. 30 is the age when your strength and maturity.
I missed it. 31.
Yeah.
Okay, last year didn't feel like anything.
Anyway. Hey, you're there. You're there. Now, anyway, you got fatherhood going on. You got a lot of things going on.
I was joking. We're okay.
We'll put you on the couch. Anyway, so this age is a big deal, and it starts here. He's the kind of like the prototype that comes into this exalting at the age of 30, and that pattern continues. And so Joseph says, Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and he went throughout all the land of Egypt. What's he doing?
Just taking it in, seeing what's going on.
He's going around saying, okay, I want you to build this number of granaries, and here you're going to put it, and this. He's like giving a lowdown in all the different districts and cities. But one of the other things that he's also doing, I think, is he's surveying the land. Like, where can we get the most production from these crops? And one of the things that happens in the 12th dynasty, put on your nerd hat again, historical stuff coming and don't glaze over. All right, so in the 12th dynasty, you have a pharaoh named Amenemhat III, which would be pretty close to precisely where you find Joseph in 1850 BC. And he is obsessed, and his records, all kinds of records about water levels and famine and the Nile flood levels. He starts massive irrigation projects, water management. He builds dikes all over Egypt. He enlarges lakes. Like, think about how brilliant this is. He would dig out huge lakes for the Nile to fill, so that if the Nile ever is deficient, you unleash the lake and it supplements the Nile so that you can protect against famines. Like, this guy's brilliant. But one of the things that he did that's really fascinating, and I've been there, I've stood along the shores of this thing, is he had a canal dug where, like, let's say this is Egypt, right? And here's the Nile. Runs like this, desert, desert. And then over here you have depressed land, right? Miles away. What he did is he said, if that's depressed land, we can dig the Nile to connect to the depressed land. The water would flow into there. We can irrigate it, and we can grow our farmland. So sometime around 1850 BC, this canal is dug. And this region called the Fayum is flooded with water, and it produces 750,000 additional acres of farmland. And you know what the canal that's dug to the Fayum to this day is called? You know what it is, don't you?
I do, yeah.
The Bar Yosef, which means the Canal of Joseph. And it's the only name we've ever had for this thing. It goes all the way back to like the 8th century, like where this thing has been called that. So it's called the Canal of Joseph. It dates exactly to where you should find Joseph. And by the way, this pharaoh, Amenemhat III, attributes so much of his reign's success to this canal and the addition of farmlands that he builds this pyramid where he's buried right next to the Bar Yosef.
Huh.
And it's like there's so much in archaeology that points to Joseph and the history. It's kind of fascinating. So anyway, that's what Joseph is doing. I'm convinced he's surveying the land, seeing how he can maximize the yield. He's a brilliant dude. So during the seven plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and he put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it, and Joseph stored up grain in abundance like the sand of the sea until he ceased to measure it, for it couldn't be measured. Like, eventually, it's like, we can't keep track.
Yeah, why? It's just coming keep counting?
So fast, we can't keep track. So before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, right? So Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. So Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's household. Now, this is not saying that he's like, I'm done with them. I, you know, forget them. I never want to see them again. What he's saying is, God has finally given me a slice of happiness and joy in this world. I've got a child. I've got a wife. I've got a life that God has given me that now I've forgotten all the pains.
It's interesting because there is kind of a forgottenness of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, what do you mean by that? Explain more.
Like, when you really forgive somebody, they're hurt, and what they've done to you is not on your mind constantly.
Correct.
Like, it's not like people are like, oh, I'll never forget the past. But it's like, no, yeah. There is a healthy part to that, to where that's not on my mind all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I've forgotten the wrong you've done to me. Just like, I mean, the Bible speaks about it clearly. Like, God writes off our sin because of forgiveness. And yet we're the ones who are like, no, he hurt me a decade ago.
Yeah.
Hold on to that one.
What's the line that Tom says? Bitterness is a poison we make for someone else, and then we drink it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like holding on to it. It's like I'm so mad at them, and yet it's poisoning me. Yeah. You know, it's, you got to let go of that. And so I think that's it. It's like, you know, you go through childbirth. The Bible makes a big deal of this, but you go through childbirth, and it's extremely painful. One of the worst pains you ever get. But the moment the baby comes out and is screaming and crying, and you put it in the mother's arms, the mother's not going, oh, the pain. It's like you've forgotten about it because you have this great joy in your arms. And I think that's what Joseph is getting at. God has given me something so beautiful. That's what he says. And he attributes it to God, by the way. God has made me forget all my hardship. And it's like, he's been so good to me. This is all worth it, to where now the pain is totally forgotten. It's gone, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, verse 52, the name of the second he called Ephraim. These are going to be two of the tribes of Israel. For God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And so Ephraim, from the Hebrew root para, is to be fruitful and multiply. So he's hearkening back to what God's call on people is, to be fruitful and multiply. So both of these names are faithful. And just as a moment here, you notice when you look at the 12 tribes, you don't see a tribe of Joseph. You ever notice that?
No, but now I do.
You won't find it. It's Manasseh and Ephraim. And the reason for that is, when you go to Israel, the land is divided into 12 tribes, but Levi is the tribe of the priest. They don't get a land. So subtract one, right? Joseph doesn't get one because it goes to his two sons. So subtract two. Now you're at 10. Guess who gets the two tribal? It's Ephraim and Manasseh. And they get massive tribes, right? So while Joseph does not get the blessing, that'll go to Judah, the line of the Messiah, Joseph does get a double portion of the inheritance, which is kind of interesting. So he does get honored. He just doesn't get the salvific line, which I think it's kind, because he deserved it.
Yeah.
Everyone's alive because of him. I shouldn't say that on a gospel show. Like, he didn't earn it or deserve it. God was gracious, but I'm glad. Right? He was a faithful guy. So verse 53, and by the way, like, I'll stop here for a moment. When you're Joseph, and like, occurred to me last night, if I'm Joseph and God comes to me and he says, I'm going to give you all power, you control the armies, you control everything, I wonder if there was any part of Joseph that would be like, it would be nice to take a little expedition up to Canaan right now.
Go get my brothers.
Yeah. I mean, either, even if you didn't want to cause them harm, to be like, God promised me that they would bow down to me. Yeah. I want to humiliate them. I want to go there with my army, and I'm going to bring that dream to fruition. I'm going to make it happen. They're going to bow down to me. He doesn't do that. It doesn't even cross his mind. I'm letting all that go.
Yeah,
and he leaves it to God's timetable to actually fulfill the dream that he got.
I guess that is true, yeah, because he could go and make that dream come true himself.
Absolutely, he could.
Wow, okay.
But he lets go of the bitterness. He doesn't like seek vengeance on his own. He trusts it to the Lord.
He's a real healthy guy.
Gosh, he is. It's like remarkable. It's really remarkable. So anyway, verse 53, the 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the lands, very repetitive chapter. But in all the land of Egypt, there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to the Egyptians, go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. So he's like,
I don't want to be a part of this.
I don't want to. If it's not broke, God's blessing him, go to him. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened up the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because famine was severe, crushing, heavy, oppressive over all the earth. So it's not just Egypt. This is spread throughout the region of Canaan, the Hittites, all the region of the Near East. Everybody's going into famine here. And so now you step back, and what is it that God has exalted Joseph to do?
Save the world. Physically.
Yeah, physically. And so his life is carrying out. And it's like, you just think of God winking and nodding and singing the gospel through the life story of Joseph. We've said this before, but let's rehearse it again. What are the details of Joseph's life? He is the father's favorite son, who is clothed in a majestic robe, set apart. Number one, he's the righteous one where everyone else is wicked. He goes to testify against his brother's sins, and they hate him. They hate him for his favoritism. They hate him because he's righteous and different. And so what do? They conspire, and Judah sells him for silver coins to those that are going down to Egypt, the land of death, where he's going to be thrown into a pit, falsely accused, stripped of his robe, put between two criminals, one of which is restored, one of which is condemned. Then, by patiently enduring what God has put in front of him without resulting to sin or selfishness, he's exalted. He comes out of the pit. He's raised up to the right hand of the Most High Power, and he uses that authority not to go get vengeance, but to forgive and to provide bread.
Yeah.
And to make a way and to prepare a home, ultimately, is where the story goes. And who is this who saves the world? I mean, God is telling this story. It's like, you know, he upends all the ways that the Egyptians believe, and they're like, no, you got it wrong. You got it wrong. It's not that. It's this. He's the one true God. And then with Joseph, it's like, okay, now let me show you the pattern of the way I work. Mm. And it's screaming, Jesus,
yeah,
who did this for you? We're the brothers. We're the idiots back home that rarely think of him, that betrayed him, that put him on a cross, that, you know, don't deserve what he's doing for us. But he goes in front of us and does all this suffering that we take for granted, that we don't even think about. Mm. And what does he say? I go to prepare a place for you right now. Right now, he is preparing a place for you, right? Moving in you, providing for you, storing up the bread of heaven that he's unleashing on you. And he's so much greater than Joseph. You know, the main difference, the one fault that I can find in Joseph, I always catch heat when I teach this, but it's the libertarian in me.
Getting comments.
We'll get it later. Is he sells the bread back to them.
Yeah, he should. It's their bread.
Right? They stored it up, and he sells it back to them. And ultimately, later on, he's, you know, Egypt's going to be, it says, reduced to servitude. Jesus doesn't do that.
Yeah,
Jesus doesn't sell the bread back to you. What does he do?
Gives it to us.
He's so much better. Even than Joseph's such a wonderful guy. And Jesus comes and is like, no, one better. I give it for free at great expense to myself. It's not the Egyptians, you know, in Joseph's terms, it's the Egyptians who are working for the bread. Joseph sells the money and gives it to Pharaoh. For Jesus, who is it that works for the bread? It's all his labor.
Yeah, he is the bread.
It's all his suffering that provides the bread for you free of charge so that you can have life. How selfless, how amazing, how wonderful, how much better a Joseph do we have in Christ? And as brilliant and beautiful as this story is, it just scratches the surface of how beautiful the gospel is.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It really is. All right, so as wonderful as that would have been as the place to land, I have one more historical thing.
Anything.
No, I'm no, bringing the history. I am. I'm just telling you. So at this time, there's famine over all the earth. What we learn later, all the nations start coming, right? And what does history show us? That it's right during this time period that you have this massive migration into Egypt. All the Egyptologists will tell you this. Nefertiti, who is in one of the wall paintings, around 1900 BC, right around the time of Joseph, writes this: all happiness has gone away. The land is cast down in trouble, not because of famine, but because of those feeders, Asiatics. This is like a guy who's not happy about foreigners coming. All those Asiatics, people from Asia, the Near East, like where Joseph's family is, who are throughout the land, enemies have arisen in the East. Asiatics have come down to Egypt, and there's this massive surge of people flooding into Egypt. Why?
It's the only place for food.
All the Egyptologists are like, it had to have been a massive famine going on. Mm. And so they all come to Egypt, and they're coming to Joseph, who saves the world. Quite literally.
Go, Joseph.
Keeps them from starving to death. And so it's a beautiful detail. I didn't want that to be missed. So we're gonna stop there. But remember, Jesus is greater.
Yep. Truth. Amen.
All right. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for watching this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next time as we get into Genesis 42 and we start seeing how God is using all this history of suffering and redemption, where we would be shaking our fists and asking why, how God is using all of that ultimately, not just to save the world, but to save this family and to redeem this family and to bring them to their senses and to bring them to himself, because that's the way he works.
Yep.
We don't always understand it, but he's always faithful, always good, always suffering. And when we're in the middle of seasons that don't make sense, it's good to remember that. So God bless. Have a great week. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.